welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, is the man of my dreams, Tom Caldwell. How are you doing, Tom?
I am quite well, thank you.
Excellent, right on. And also joining us, as he always does, who's pointing an oddly shaped wheel in my general direction, Chris Haig. How are you doing?
Yes, it's me. I'm your nightmare dressed like a daydream. I had to remember the lyric then, sorry. if you can tell me what song that's from, thank you. I am okay.
Lady Gaga.
No, it's pop, I'll give you that, but yeah. I'm okay. Just getting by, as we all are.
Yes, excellent. Well, we're getting by watching some fun Hitchcock films, and we've got joining us a second-time guest, because she originally contributed to our episode number 2, I think it was number 2, maybe number 3, way back in the day when we did our Friends of the Show episode, talking about some of their experiences with Hitchcock. Jera Hodge from the Women at Warp Star Trek podcast. How's it going, Jera?
I'm feeling strangely guilty, but I'm not sure if I actually did anything or if it's just a complex.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I mean, that's also a result of isolation.
Yeah.
If you don't have a complex before appearing on this show, you'll have one after.
Excellent.
There's our new tagline. Yeah.
If you don't have a complex before, you'll have one after. Awesome. Well, yeah, thank you so much for joining us, Jera. I really appreciate it. Way back in the day when we were, you know, setting this up, it was like 3 years ago now, maybe 4 years ago, you had mentioned that you wanted to discuss Spellbound. Why don't you tell us a little bit of your history with Hitchcock and why you chose this film and why this film means what it does to you?
Sure. So my first real time watching any Hitchcock movies was through feminist film theory class in university, in which this was one of the films we watched. And Hitchcock is often shown in these classes, because it exemplifies so many filmmaking, style moments and, tropes and themes that are now in many cases, like, kind of cliche, but of course we're not at the time. And so it's a really good, way to look at the way that film has depicted men and women in particular, and kind of, you know, boil it down to that, those, some of those early essences, and also just, you know, fun watching with some interesting suspenseful stories and creative insertions of other things that were prominent theories at the time. So particularly this film, I've gone on to watch many more films than I watched in that class, but this one always sticks with me as something, well, we'll talk more about why, but something that really shows things of the time that were really groundbreaking, even though it's in some cases, I think, a little bit silly now, but I find it really enjoyably silly. So, yeah.
Awesome. Right on. Well, I'm looking forward to hearing some of your thoughts on this movie. Chris, why don't you do us a favor and tell us a little bit about what the show is about, what the movie's about.
Okay. So what I'll do is I'll give a little summary, because I don't want to spoil anything until we get start talking about the film. But if you have never seen Spellbound, or you have no idea what it's about, here is what it's about. When Dr. Anthony Edwards, played by Gregory Peck, arrives at Vermont Mental Hospital to replace the outgoing hospital director, Dr. Constance Peterson, Ingrid Bergman, a psychoanalyst, she discovers Dr. Edwards is actually an imposter. The man confesses that the real Dr. Edwards is dead, and fears that he may have killed him, but he cannot recall anything. Dr. Peterson, however, is convinced his imposter is innocent of the man's murder and joins him on a quest to unravel his amnesia through psychoanalysis. Dun, dun, dun.
I think the best part about Anthony Edwards was his acting career after this, like when he got a starring role on ER and whatnot. It was really quite amazing.
Different guy.
Oh, okay, sorry. Anyways, I've got quite a bit of notes on this movie here, and I'm not even just barely scratch the surface when it comes to the two main actors. But buckle your seatbelts, and here we go. Just bear with me while I go through this. Spellbound is a 1945 American film noir psychological mystery thriller directed by Alfred Hitchcock. The film stars Ingrid Bergman, Gregory Peck, Michael Chekhov, and Leo G. Carroll. It's an adaptation by Angus MacPhail and Ben Hecht of the novel The House of Dr. Edwards from 1927 by Hilary St. George Saunders and John Palmer. The release date is listed on Wikipedia as it had a premiere on October 31st, 1945 in New York City, and then a general release of December 28th, 1945, and a running time of 111 minutes. Now, Spellbound was made over contract disagreements between Hitchcock and producer David O. Selznick. Hitchcock's contract with Selznick began in March of 1939, but only resulted in three films, Spellbound, Rebecca, and The Paradine Case. Notorious was sold to RKO in mid-production. Selznick wanted Hitchcock to make a movie based upon Selznick's own positive experience with psychoanalysis. Selznick even brought in his therapist, May Rahm, M.D., who is credited in the film as a technical advisor. Dr. Rahm and Hitchcock clashed frequently. Further contention was caused by the hiring of surrealist artist Salvatore Dali to conceive certain scenes in the film's key dream sequence. However, the sequence conceived and designed by Dali and Hitchcock, once translated to film, proved to be too lengthy and complicated for Selznick. So the vast majority of what had been filmed ultimately was edited out. 2 minutes of the dream sequence appear in the final film, but according to Ingrid Bergman, the original had been 20 minutes long. The cut footage apparently no longer exists, although some production stills have survived in the Selznick archives. Eventually, Selznick hired William Cameron Menzies, who had worked on Gone with the Wind, to oversee the set designs and direct the sequence. Hitchcock himself had very little to do with its actual filming. Spellbound was shot in black and white, except for two frames of bright red at the conclusion when Dr. Murchison's gun is fired into the camera. The detail was deleted in most 16mm and video formats, but it was restored for the film's DVD release and airings on Turner Classic Movies. Selznick originally wanted Joseph Cotten, Dorothy McGuire, and Paul Lucas to play the roles ultimately portrayed by Peck, Bergman, and Chekhov, respectively. Greta Garbo was considered for the role of Dr. Constance Peterson, and Hitchcock wanted Joseph Cotten to portray Dr. Murchison. Selznick also wanted Jennifer Jones to portray Dr. Peterson, but Hitchcock objected. Ingrid Bergman and Gregory Peck were both married to others at the time of the production, Bergman to Peter Aaron Lindstrom and Peck to Greta Kukkonen, but they had a brief affair during the filming of the film. Their secret relationship became public knowledge when Peck confessed to Brad Derrick of People in a 1987 interview, 5 years after Bergman's death. And a quote from him is, "All I can say is that I had a real love for Bergman, and I think that's where I ought to stop. I was young, she was young, we were involved for weeks in close and intense work." The film features an orchestral score by Miklos Rozsa that pioneered the use of the theremin, performed by Dr. Samuel Hoffman. Selznick originally wanted Bernard Herrmann, but when Herrmann became unavailable, Rozsa was hired and eventually won the Oscar for his score. Although Rozsa considered Spellbound to contain some of his best work, he said Alfred Hitchcock didn't like the music. He said it got in the way of his direction. I haven't seen him since. During the film's protracted post-production, considerable disagreement arose about the music, exacerbated by the lack of communication between producer, director, and composer. Rozsa had scored another film, The Lost Weekend, before Spellbound was released, and he had used the theremin in that score as well. This led to allegations that he had recycled music from Selznick's film in the Paramount production. Meanwhile, Selznick's assistant tampered with the Spellbound scoring by replacing some of Rozsa's material with earlier music by Franz Waxman and Roy Webb. The tangled history of the scoring process has been explored by Jack Sullivan and especially Nathan Platt, both of which qualify and sometimes contradict the early accounts of the participants. Now, the film was nominated for a total of 6 Academy Awards, winning for original score, but it was also nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting Actor, Best Cinematography, and Best Visual Effects. Now, before we wrap up, we got the little bit about the actors. Ingrid Bergman was a Swedish actress who starred in a variety of European and American films, television movies, and plays. She won many accolades, including 3 Academy Awards, 2 Primetime Emmy Awards, a Tony Award, 4 Golden Globe Awards, and a BAFTA Award. Bergman was born in Stockholm to a Swedish father and a German mother and started her acting career in Swedish and German films. Her introduction to Americans came in the English language remake of Intermezzo. In addition to the classic and Best Picture Academy Award winning Casablanca opposite Humphrey Bogart, her notable performances from the 40s include the dramas For Whom the Bell Tolls, Gaslight, The Bells of St. Mary's, and Joan of Arc, all of which earned her nominations for the Academy Award for Best Actress. She won the award for Gaslight. She made 3 films with Hitchcock, including Spellbound with Gregory Peck and Notorious opposite Cary Grant. And so in addition to this one in Notorious, we will see her again in Under Capricorn. And for Gregory Peck, Gregory Peck's name is actually Eldred Gregory Peck, and he was an American actor. He was one of the most popular film stars from the 40s and all the way through the 60s. Peck received 5 nominations for Academy Awards for Best Actor and won once for his performance as Atticus Finch in the 1962 drama film To Kill a Mockingbird. Peck's other Oscar-nominated roles are The Keys of the Kingdom, The Yearling, Gentleman's Agreement, and 12 O'Clock High. Other notable films in which he appeared include The Gunfighter, Roman Holiday, Moby Dick, The Big Country, The Guns of Navarone, Cape Fear, both versions, How the West Was Won, The Omen, and The Boys from Brazil. U.S. President Lyndon Johnson honored Peck with the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1969 for his lifetime humanitarian efforts. In 1999, the American Film Institute named Peck among the greatest male stars of classic Hollywood cinema, ranking him at number 12. We will see him again in The Paradine Case. And Hitchcock's cameo is a signature occurrence in almost all his films. In Spellbound, he can be seen coming out of an elevator at the Empire State Hotel carrying a violin case and smoking a cigarette about 39 minutes into the film. Awesome. Well, that's what I got. Thank you for bearing with me, guys. Let's discuss this film.
Your dictation leaves me spellbound.
Ooh, awesome. Thank you very much. Now, before we do get started, now, Tom, you wanted to mention something that you found about the music.
Oh, I spend about 10 or 12 hours researching every film. So there was a reference in one of the books I was reading that the love theme from this film by Rosa is very similar to the what is known as the Star Wars love theme, which I believe is the Across the Stars Suite, the Anakin Padme love theme. So if you have a chance, Google the 2 tracks, give them a listen. I think there's a lot of similarity.
I'm really glad that it wasn't just me imagining that.
Now, I'm not a Star Wars guy. I would never have caught the connection if I hadn't found it. But you noticed that when you watched the film, did you?
Well, the first thing I noticed, because the overture is the very first thing at the beginning, and it's pretty much just the love theme, is I was like, oh man, this does not seem like it's going to be a scary movie at all. Like, this seems like, it's black and white, so you see these, like, leaves fluttering on trees, but you don't know that this is supposed to be, like, eerie death time yet, until the theremin kicks in, like, a few scenes later. So, you have a lot of time to think about that love theme, and I was like, I don't know what this is like. It's sort of like Star Wars. Apparently not just me.
And I love the fact that there was the opening, what did they call it, the opening overture and the closing music. Like, that was very traditional and very... The only other time I remember seeing that is in Gone with the Wind, when on a television showing of that movie, there's an intermission, which is like a title slide, and music. Mm-hmm. And on TV, they showed the intermission. Mm-hmm. That was very authentic. I enjoyed mm-hmm. that.
I'm glad that they've started doing that on home media releases. I mean, it's been going on for a while now, but, you know, so many movies will have that intermission, that overture and whatnot at the beginning, and outro at the end, and it is a part of the original movie experience, so it should be there. I remember the first time I came across it was on my home video version of 2001 A Space Odyssey, and it didn't say, it was on VHS, and it didn't say overture, it just played the music, and so I'm like, what is going on here? Why is there all this music with nothing happening? So I just kept fast forwarding it until the credits started. But when I was older, I figured out what all that meant. So
right on.
So Jarrah, why don't we go with you? What is your initial impressions of this film after revisiting it after probably a while since you've seen it before?
Really, my major impression for why this film stood out to me and why I actually like it more upon every rewatch is that I really, really like the character of Constance Peterson, and I think she's a really competent, badass lady detective psychoanalyst who really stands out in film of the time for kind of being this central protagonist who is very skilled and doesn't take crap from people. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My main takeaway.
Chris, what are your initial thoughts on the film? Was this the first time you've seen it?
No, so I'd actually seen it a few years ago, because in the UK, I don't know if this is a North American thing, but on a Sunday paper, there used to be free promotional stuff and stuff. There was a decent two-year chunk of time where you'd get free DVDs with Sunday paper. And we're not talking like full case, they're like little cardboard sleeves and all that sort of thing, but I watched quite a lot of older films because of that. So I watched like A Matter of Life and Death, and I watched like war films and all that sort of thing, and one of them was Spellbound, and I still have it's in my DVD case now in its little cardboard sleeve. So I remember watching it and really enjoying it, and then at the time I was watching it, I was in uni/college doing psychology, so for me it was really interesting hearing them talk about psychoanalysis and psychodynamic theory and all that sort of thing, and then looking over and seeing Ingrid Bergman, basically, like Jarrah said, being possibly one of my favourite Hitchcock characters ever, or just characters generally, because she's this sort of intelligent and strong and kind of hyper competent, but also still really compassionate and just really smart and enjoyable to watch. And in fact, I'd have watched the character in a bunch of different films, and she probably could have resolved a lot of them much quicker. A lot of the dramas being like, yes, okay, I'll solve this, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But no, I really enjoy this film. I think it's a really interesting thriller. It fits into a lot of Hitchcock's kind of pre-existing patterns in terms of, well, it's basically his template of man is accused of crime, is innocent, teams up with woman to help resolve it. You know, and we've seen this in like the 39 Steps. We've seen this in Young and Innocent. We will see it in, you know, North by Northwest, all that sort of thing. So, I just really enjoyed this. It also really helps that Gregory Peck is basically my black and white crush. So this is really mm-hmm. easy for me to watch. I'm there like, of course I'll help you. Well, of course you didn't kill anyone. I'm getting like really involved in it, and I'm like, how dare you kill the killer? Look at him with that jawline. Yeah, but no, I really had a lot of fun with this.
Awesome. Tom, what are your thoughts? Have you seen this before?
I don't recall seeing this before, and I didn't mean that as an amnesia pun. but I enjoyed it. It was kind of dry and boring for the first 40 minutes before she went into New York City. But it gets very entertaining in the last hour. And in general, I enjoyed the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen it once before. Like, I've got the Criterion Edition on DVD, which is now out of print. And I remember really liking it. But when I popped it on this time, I'm like, see, this beginning seems to be a little bit slow and whatnot. But probably right around the same time that you started to get into it, I'm like, no, this is really starting to captivate me, and this is kind of a really interesting story, and I think it finished really, really strong, and I think it's a really great film. I recently On my Fantasia 2000 Blu-ray, there's a short film that they finished that Disney and Dolly worked on, and it like originally was never finished in the 60s or whenever it was that they worked on it, and it was about 40 years later that they decided to go back and finish it. But there was like an hour-long documentary on Salvador Dali, that like his rise to fame and whatnot, and there was a section about him working with Hitchcock on it that I just watched recently, so it's kind of neat to tie that into this. But I know that Dali is one of those surrealist painters that people like to look at and psychoanalyze his work and whatnot with the melting clocks, and so it was neat to see that with the distorted wheel and whatnot that represented the gun from the dream sequence.
Well, am I correct in thinking that he would later work with Dali on Vertigo for the nightmare sequence there? Or am I thinking...
I think this is the only time that he and Dali worked together.
Huh. Might be Dali.
We'll find out, I guess, hey?
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure it's just this one here.
Imagine what that dream sequence would have looked like with today's filmmaking technology.
Oh, I'm so annoyed that it's lost, because I'm like, obviously they couldn't have had a 20-minute dream sequence. It would have been the weirdest thing in the world. But I would pay money to see.
Well, I mean, it would have been like the ballet in the middle of Oklahoma, right? Like, you try to watch that as a modern viewer, and you're just going like, why am I watching 20 minutes of dancing in the middle of a movie? But at the time, those things were just so cool because they hadn't been done before.
There's a lot of talk about psychoanalysis at the time was all the trend in Hollywood. It was the fad. It was the fashion of the age. It was considered to be the... kind of the aristocratic equivalent of the Catholic confessional. Freudism was an orthodox faith, so this was a huge fad at the time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the viewers would have perhaps enjoyed all the psychological and the dream sequence and everything. It would have been very popular with the general public, I think.
But I think this was the first time that the idea of like psychotherapy in terms of like the talking cure was actually really shown in popular film or television. And so even though this was becoming a fad in other ways, this was still like on the leading edge in terms of representing it in the popular imagination. And I think that some of these ideas went a ways to sort of cementing the types of like what very much become stereotypes or cliches of like the Freudian psychoanalyst with the cigar and the like the accent, yeah. Like her mentor and stuff in later media.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And, you know, if you think about it, when you look at the way that psychology and mental health and treatment gets shown, so you have films like The Snake Pit with Olivia de Havilland, which was in 1944, I want to say. It was in the 1940s, I believe, and that was the first case of showing a woman who goes into what was it was then called a mental asylum, and now it's a treatment centre, and, you know, her trials are going through it and all that sort of thing. But it is, you know, Spellbound is interesting because you are completely right in that it looks at what psychological treatment in terms of the talking cure and Freud and, you know, what would become really popular all the way up until today. And it, you know, it informs stuff like cognitive behavioral therapy. It informs stuff, you know, most people know if you say id, ego and superego, you know what those terms are, even if you don't know, oh, well, it was developed with this background or, you know, whatever the case is. And it's interesting because at the time, you know, some of the most popular psychological methods, I mean, some of them are still used today, so we still have electroconvulsive therapy, which people still use to treat depression in severe cases. It's interesting that, yeah, if it was this sort of fad, it was like, oh, well, we're going to try out this new thing and see how it works, and it sort of sensationalises it a bit and maybe makes it seem a bit more dramatic than those cases would be. But as a tool for a film, I think it's absolutely fantastic. I think it's really fun.
I knew, Chris, that you would enjoy this film from your professional background.
I know. That's the thing. I watched it as a student, and now that I've gone through it nearly 10-ish years later, I'm still there watching it being a nerd, being like, this is fun! Even though I'm like, well, obviously... that's the thing. I get so... not giddy, but I'm watching it and being like, oh yeah, okay, so they're talking about this or they're talking about that. So, you know, in the beginning of the film, you have a woman who is... I don't know how you would.
She's a nymphomaniac. Yeah, was apparently how it was described in the script.
I believe. I don't know. I don't know how to really describe it now, because it is. It almost looks like there's some kind of borderline personality disorder or something going on there, because of the way that she switches depending on who she's talking to, in the sense of, oh, if she's talking to Constance, she's quite aggressive. She's kind of like, well, you don't tell me what to do, and she's throwing shit, and it's just all that sort of thing. But then the minute, you know, a doctor walks in, so it doesn't matter if it be Dr. Edwards or if it's, I forgot his name, the director.
Richardson.
That's it, thank you.
The French guy who's always hitting on her.
Yeah, the friend, yeah. Either of them, she immediately, it's like turning on the charm and it's that sort of thing. So whether or not it is nymphomaniac, because back then they used it to cover a variety of kind of disorders. Hysteria was still a thing because they were like, you know, we were only a few decades away from, you know, oh, hysteria, it's a woman's disease because, you know, the uterus travels around the body and that's what it causes all the madness and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, if you're interested in psychological theory, it's a fun thriller, but I wouldn't go into it being like, oh yeah, this is super accurate, you guys. this is like a documentary, because it's really, I have to stress this, it really isn't.
I also don't think most asylums were that nice. Like, I know that they dramatically improved, but there were, you know, exposés after this point, but Green Manor seems like very civilized.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, if you're looking for one that's a bit more accurate, then yeah, I would recommend The Snake Pit, which is a lot more kind of true to life and that sort of thing. I mean, there's also, basically, it's just the only other film I can really recommend that is quite good and is similar-ish, if you want to know what psychological therapy was like in the 40s and 50s. The Three Faces of Eve is quite good. It's a bit sensationalist, but it's quite close. With Joanne Woodward? Yeah. That's quite fun as well. But yeah. Back to
I spot. Found the formality of the structure of the asylum at the beginning was quite overdone. And everything was basically, doctor, I'd like you to meet the doctor. And the fine dining with the china and the carefully eating the soup, like in a formal setting, and that was a little bit hard to believe as a psychiatric institution.
Yeah, I mean, like Jarrah said, it's probably much nicer, more sort of glamorous than it would have been in those cases. But you know, I think there was still a much more strict formal. There was none of, you know, in terms of modern. So in the UK, we have something called CAMHS, which is about a mental health service, and it's all very kind of friendly, and it's like, hey, you know, I'm going to eat with the residents, and I'm going to do all this sort of thing. I imagine it would be much more formal in the 30s and 40s, and it would be, they probably wouldn't be seeing doctor as much. Doctor, this is doctor. Ah, it's doctor.
I like when they all stand up when she comes in to dinner the second time.
Yeah. That's so good. Well, on the back of that, can we just talk how good Ingmar Bergman is in this?
Yeah, I want to talk about her character because, you know, in the times that we're living in right now, and with the awareness that's been made to me about things like the Me Too movement and whatnot, watching it this time, I think that Hitchcock, in the way that Bergman's character is portrayed, is a very sympathetic portrayal of this character because, you know, she's a professional woman working in an environment with a lot of men. And, you know, she's got this one doctor that's like hitting on her and calling her, you know, frigid and whatnot. And she's just trying to be professional in the environment. And, you know, they keep talking to her like, oh, someday you're going to fall in love and then you're basically not going to be able to do your job anymore because emotions and yada, yada. And, you know, so Bergman's character is walking this almost tightrope walk of how she's got to act and whatnot because of the time that she's in. And I think Hitchcock did a very good job of portraying that sympathetically, because when she does eventually fall in love, her character's shown that she's still completely capable of doing her job and analyzing things, you know, and it's not something that has impacted her at all. And I thought that was a very interesting approach, looking at it through a lens of now, like modern times and whatnot.
Yeah, definitely. The novelist Lucy Ellman has an article in the New York Times where she talks about this all as basically a Me Too allegory, and says that of Constance, she's not just studious, she's a well of irony and snappy put downs which help her wrestle her way through a forest of obnoxious men. Mm-hmm. There's like the guy with the package in the hotel where she's basically like, could you not sit on my lap, please? and the French named guy. She has these great comebacks. But even when, like you said, even after she falls in love with Ballantyne, who she doesn't know is Ballantyne yet. Sorry, spoiler there. she is still very much running the show. Like, she is he pulls out these things, you know, like, there's nothing I loathe more or hate more than this isn't the exact quote, but like, uppity women, like women, smug women. And she's just like, oh, we're just starting. It's kind of great that I don't think that they present it in a way that she's like mean or unjustified, but she's just really holding her own in a society that's like quite aggressively aligned against women in authoritative roles.
Mm-hmm.
I think my favorite moment of the entire film, she worked that hotel detective like a Rubik's cube. Like, she conned him perfectly, because the biggest barrier in a proper hotel is to find out what room a guest is in, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. a confidentiality thing. And she basically just got that detective to tell her the room number. And you can see the expression on his face later when the bellman comes back to the detective in the lobby and says, you know, hey, this wanted woman from the newspaper is up in this hotel room. And the detective's like, oh my God, I got conned.
Mm-hmm.
That was brilliant. I really enjoyed that part.
Yeah, because she basically doesn't do anything other than just agree with what he thinks he's discovering. It's just like, oh, right. Yeah, how did you know that I'm definitely a teacher?
I'm a teacher, yeah.
Well, she uses the tools that she's learned, that she's great at her job at, and yeah, it's really satisfying. Because you're there just like, because you've already been established, and I think it helps the film in that she's the protagonist, as much as you might think, oh, well, it's going to be Gregory Peck who's the hero and all that sort of thing. It's actually Constance who's our lead in, and we see her mm-hmm. first, we meet her first. That sequence and kind of the confrontation at the end with Murchison is really satisfying, because you're like, oh, this is, she doesn't like need rescuing. There isn't any kind of contrivance where it's going to be like, oh, thank God you saved it. It's like, no, she's just ridiculously smart and competent. And, like you said, basically tricks him by just kind of not disagreeing.
Mm-hmm.
Just going like, oh, yes, how did you? How did mm-hmm. you find that out? Oh my God, yes. And it was, yes, that's definitely true. And all that sort of thing. And then when she reasons it out with Merchant at the end, saying, well, the first murder, you could have argued that. However, if you kill me, you are going to fry. So
you're too mm-hmm. smart for that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Again, so she kind of just works around, and, you know, even though he does end up kind of taking his own way out, it's a very... she was able to get to remove herself from the problem by basically going, right, by killing me, there is 0 point, and you are just going to do that, so let's take that off the table. Let's mm-hmm. do that. So she does have this great range of skills into, you know, she's a great problem solver, she's very logical, but it doesn't mean that she's cold. That I really enjoy, because she is a nuanced, kind of fleshed out character. She is, like, you know, really compassionate towards Ballantyne and his issues, and does work towards him with his trauma and everything. And she clearly really cares about her job. So yeah, it was, I won't say refreshing, because I think Hitchcock does, you know, not all the time, but he does have these great heroines who kind of stand out. And it was really... She really what makes the film for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that final sequence is such a Hitchcock moment when that gun comes up, right? And it's like that massive hand with the gun and it's like following her along. Like, that's such a Hitchcock thing. Like, he's done stuff like that before. We'll see a big finger like that again in Dial M for Murder. Mm. You know, like these giant props that he uses in order to get kind of what he wants. And then when the gun, like, turns around, like, you can see that it's a fake hand. Like, it's like a I read one of the books that I normally look at, and they talked about it's like a big giant wooden hand, and it was built that big so they could keep her in focus, and that it was like necessary in order to do it. And then when he's drinking the cup of milk, it was like a clear bucket. Like, it was really large to get over the whole lens of the camera, and then it, like, poured into a trough, like, below the camera, the milk did, when Gregory Peck's character is drinking the milk in the middle of the film. Some very, very typical Hitchcock decisions.
Talking about the photography, what did you think of the skiing down the hill special effects?
Oh, yes, that very, very, very... rear processed.
I like
that. Was some James Bond level work right there.
Yeah, you're like, it's blowing their hair, but like, we've all seen those movies of actual people skiing by this point. Of course, no one at the time had seen these, with like the slow-mo of like the face flaps and stuff, and how like it blows your whole face back, and at minimum your eyes should be blinking, but they're like almost not blinking. They're just like looking at each other dramatically while their hair blows slightly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Peck was just basically, he could have been standing at a bus stop in the rain. You wouldn't have known the difference, right? Like, it was so unbelievable. But again, what is the experience of the film viewer of the day, right? So
you're hopefully captivated in the plot that you're not looking at the background.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that he's staring, like, it's good because, you know, at this point you still don't know what's going on. Like, is he guilty? Is he not guilty? You're hoping that he's innocent, but Hitchcock's playing it up by having Gregory Peck give her these side looks, these evil side looks, mm-hmm. right? And then we start getting those flashes of what happened with him and his brother at a young age.
Oh,
we get
no.
that awesome dummy thrown onto the fence, right? But, you know, as we find out that he accidentally killed his brother.
That was a very powerful scene, actually. Mm-hmm. And it happened very quickly, and it was very powerful, and again, unique for Hitchcock that a child dies on camera. Like, that was very, very unusual, and made a very big impression
yeah.
on everybody.
I mean, that's the scene, whenever I think of Spellbound, that's the first scene that comes to mind, because it's the skiing down, and you realize the white on the black, and it's the, you know, lines and all that sort of thing. And yeah, I'll be honest, the first time I really wasn't expecting the kid to go on the fence, so I kind of went, oh god, no. And then I watched it back, I went, oh, it's a dummy, it's fine. Because part of me was like, oh my god, did they actually kill a child? Like, you know, I'm not that mad. But that was part of me going like, oh god, did they have like a little person and dress them up and throw them on, or just, I don't know. It was just the visual of it, and I can still see it in my head when I think about it. But yeah, that whole sequence, and then where it has that kind of dramatic resolution is very powerful.
So is the connection to Peck's character at the beginning in the dining room freaking out about the fork carving mm-hmm. on the, that's the boy dying on the spikes
yes.
on top of the fence, right? Is
yeah.
his problem with forks and different textures and visuals that remind him of that throughout the film?
I'm still not certain how that all fits in, because, you know, the lines at first are like skiing, and it's like mm-hmm. tracks in the snow is the skiing because that's where it happened. But then when you tie it back to the trauma of his youth, there isn't really lines there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and there's also a fair amount just written about that, like, tablecloth knife thing as being, like,
sexual
genital imagery, and that he needs to, like, wipe it out with the knife that always stands in for the phallus and things like that. And, I mean, it's not that out of the realm of possibility that thinking entered into it, given that they had this psychoanalyst consultant and stuff, although certainly it doesn't seem like Hitchcock was that, you know, enthused about working with her and or like the subject matter at all. But yeah,
I remember that on one of the bonus features for the DVD that I have, they were talking about that. And you know, sometimes I think, like, I think they might be looking a little bit too much into it and whatnot, but they're like, the way, the shape of the pool that she was doing and how it was like this oval, you know, weird oblong shape, you know, and they're saying, oh, that's the female reproductive organs. And I'm like, ah, I think you're reaching here on this one now, but, you know, that's just me, and I'm not a genius.
Sometimes
at
a cigar is just
analysis
a cigar.
Myself, so
yeah, I know, but it's the whole thing, because it is a lot of it's like, ah, you dreamt of smoking a cigar, it means you have a penis fixation. You're just like, nope, it's because I smoke. I don't, but yeah.
But when you look at the intersection of like psychoanalysis and crime, and particularly stabbing, that analysis comes in frequently, and I'm not really like a big subscriber to psychoanalysis myself and Freudian theory, but it is like part of that narrative that like the a knife is, or like a razor that you pick up in your girlfriend's mentor's bathroom is like a stand-in, and that it's like an expression of your Oedipal complex that you want to stab a woman. But again, not necessarily my personal set of beliefs.
When he picked up that straight blade in the bathroom, I thought he was going to harm himself immediately. Mm. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, in real life, how many people have died at the edge of a straight blade, like in murdering and stabbings? Like, those things were vicious. Mm-hmm. And I understand they were the only thing they could do for men to shave, you know, technology-wise in the day, but those things were wicked. I was watching another, Godfather of Harlem, and there's a lot of killings that they do with those where they just reach out and cut the guy's throat. It's like, those things are wicked.
Yeah. Well, why don't we jump into the dream sequence a little bit now, and what are your guys' thoughts on Dolly, and what are your guys' thoughts on this dream sequence being in this film?
It was entertaining. I think it was an interesting bit of history for us to see what Dolly was all about, and it's a good introduction for us to maybe, or the viewers of the film, to look into that artist some more. And it was very unique for a Hitchcock film. Like, he basically handed over that section to a different artistic director for that period. Like, you don't really see that in the other Hitchcock films.
I like the symbolism with, like, the cutting the eyes on the curtain, and there's been so much stuff just written about what does that mean, in addition to the fact that it was an allusion to a previous movie that Dolly had worked on, but you know, the eye as a symbol, and then cutting the eye, and all this stuff, and I love that there's so many layers to it, so even, you know, if some of the stuff wasn't intentional, or even is maybe, like, taking a psychoanalysis too far, I like the fact that people can spend that much time unpacking, like, every few minutes of this movie.
Oh man, I remember in film class in university, we watched Chien Andalou, and like we did not know anything about it, right? And it's like, there's just a short film, and there's that scene where that barber is like doing up that straight edge, and he walks up to that woman, and just they cut and they close up to the eye, and it's just like, like the entire class like flipped out when it happened, because we weren't expecting it, right? And they told us afterward how they did it and whatnot, but still, it's just like, what did I just see?
Yeah,
because he directed that. Salvatore Dali directed that with what's the other guy's name? Like, famous
Truffaut,
famous movie director. I can't remember his name right now, but yeah. No, he directed one called The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie or whatnot, and he directed all... I don't really like him as a director. I think his movies are just garbage, but he's popular. I can't remember his name right now, but he's in the Criterion Collection a lot.
I think it could have stood to be a little longer, if not 22 minutes longer, but they were saying that some of the stuff they cut was Ingrid Bergman dressed as, like, the Roman goddess Diana with arrows sticking into her neck, and she's, like, turning into a statue. And then there was other stuff that was written but not actually filmed because it would have been too expensive. Like, Salvador Dali wanted to do a ballroom scene where they're dancing and there's all these grand pianos suspended above their heads. That would have been pretty awesome if it wasn't really, really cost prohibitive.
Wow. That would have been amazing. That if it came out today, there would have been like a director's cut DVD with the extended dream cut.
Mm-hmm.
It does feel very quick. Like when he starts talking about it, he's like, and then this, and then this, and then this. And it feels very quick when the dream sequence happens on screen, when he jumps from topic to topic in it. So I think you could tell that stuff was cut out there. And knowing that after the fact, you're like, yeah, there's definitely stuff that's missing from there.
Especially because then they just miraculously solve all the crime. They're like, from that point, it's basically like almost everything falls into place because they understood that one dream.
Well, I was going to say, hashtag release the Hitchcock cut. sorry, at the time of filming, it's kind of a thing. I really enjoyed the dream sequence. And the reason why I brought up Vertigo previously was because it's not similar, but it deals with a similar sort of thing, and Hitchcock has been known to kind of play around with dreams and all that sort of thing. But yeah, I love all the stuff where like a guy with no face, or like the blank playing cards, and you know, all the symbolism that ties into it. I love all that kind of stuff, so I enjoyed it. And yeah, ideally they will find the missing 20 minutes in like a reel somewhere in Brazil, and they'll go, oh, we can now do the full version of Spellbound, and I would love that. So if anyone has any old film reels kicking about, maybe I'll check.
Well, it's crazy where they find some of this stuff. I mean, we've talked about it on the show before, you know, like there was like some insane asylum in Germany or wherever where they found like the complete cut of the original silent Passion of Joan of Arc, and they found a bunch of missing footage from in some, I don't know, like Guatemalan closet. And they found the extended cut
That's the one I was thinking of when I saw Metropolis for the first time. It was a year after they'd found it. And I was a uni student, and I was so excited. Because I was like, oh, there's only like 30 seconds missing where one of the characters escapes, and they just put like a little intertitle in. But as I said, apart from that, they've managed to pretty much restore the whole film. And I was like, oh, this sounds really cool.
Jer, is there anything else in the film that we haven't touched on that you want to address? Some of the stuff that was talked about in your class?
Well, this was definitely not talked about in my class, but one of the parts that always sticks in my head just because I find it really funny is the part where the cops or the detectives are like looking at the headshot of Ingrid Bergman and they draw glasses on it with a marker, and then they're like, does this look like her? And they're all being very serious, and you can totally just imagine like them being like drawing a little mustache and like... It just looks so cheesy. Yeah, that one is not at all theoretically important, but I just find it hilarious.
One of the books I read mentioned that's pretty much a glamour shot from the studio, too. That's no police mugshot or file photo.
Yeah. But I think, like, one of the things we did talk about in class is, you know, it all starts out with the quote about the fault being not in our stars, but in ourselves. And that's really kind of a central piece of this movie, is that tension about did he do it or not? And is this, you know, something that is... you know, this idea of like things being locked in you that you can let out and then kind of reconstitute. And by letting out those things, you will resolve your problems and restore reason, which I just think is a really interesting theme to explore. And I think there's a lot of tension in this movie. And even though it does have a fairly clean and happy ending, is like not all those questions really get resolved. So I think it's a food for discussion and thought.
Right on.
Tom, is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't addressed yet?
I would not recommend this as an entry-level film for people that aren't familiar with Hitchcock, because it would really throw them off, because it's not very typical, and it wouldn't be a good example of how entertaining the films can be.
It is interesting because it really is heavily, primarily the love story, but it is very heavily intertwined with the mystery. I mean, there is a lot of very Hitchcock themes in it, like the innocent man, right? And they really play it up in this, because we usually know right away in Hitch's films that the person is innocent, and this one we don't. We don't find out until the very end that he actually is innocent. And they even give you the fake out where they say he's innocent, and then they're like, nope, he's going to jail, right? And it's at the last scene when the one guy reveals a line where he partially knew, oh, I only knew Edward slightly. So he would have known that that wasn't him when he showed up, right? As a way to give away that who he was and that he was the murderer and whatnot. But it is interesting that it kind of does flip the Hitchcock style on its head a little bit more heavily on the love and a little bit more heavily on the doubt of the guilt of the main character.
And honestly, I think that if the ending had been different and if we found out he did do it, then it would negate a lot of what makes Constance such a standout, amazing character, because then the script would actually be like this silly woman who was thrown off her path by love instead of the one who like had unshakable faith in her instinct and her skill.
Yeah, that's very interesting too. Yeah, because that if that would have been played out in the complete opposite, had he turned out to be guilty.
Yeah,
for sure. Chris, anything else you want to talk about that we haven't mentioned yet?
Not really, I mean, I think we've covered it. I mean, all I would say really is, yeah, I'd agree with Tom to say this is not a great entryway into Hitchcock if you're wanting to, you know, an easy introduction or see what he's about, that sort of thing. I would say it's pretty top tier for me because I really enjoy this film. It's got great kind of acting, it's shot really well, the story is really engaging. What I would say is watch it if you've got any kind of question or if you fancy a 1940s thriller that is a bit different, because it is marketed as a film noir and it is an early psychological thriller. And it is an interesting blend of the two because, you know, psychological thrillers, you can look at something from the 40s and maybe you're looking at, for example, Gaslight, which again has Ingrid Bergman in. Or you can look at the film noirs, like Laura, which came out either the same year or the year before. And I think they're both fantastic examples of how you can, use really strong characters and a really great plot and that sort of thing. And I think Spellbound really works for that. It's a very... It's sort of elegant and weird at the same time, which I really enjoy, because it is really well put together. You know, this is probably my favourite performance by Ingrid Bergman, although we do have a couple more coming up, so that might change. And I really enjoy Gregory Peck, and the whole cast is fantastic. So yeah, I would say definitely check this one out. We've covered some great films on this podcast and some not-so-great films. And this is one I would heartily recommend that you see as soon as you can.
Yeah, I like this one a lot. It held up on a rewatch for me. I remembered, you know, right away jumping in, I'm like, okay, I know that he's the guilty one because I'd seen it before. And I was watching for things and the mystery holds up at all the way to the end, I think, because I couldn't remember what the giveaway was. So I thought it was really well done and I'm glad we revisited for this. And I'm going to jump in right away. I'm going to give my rating and I'm going to give this film 4 out of 5 funky wheel guns.
I will give it 3.5 out of 5 house detective job postings.
I will give it 4 out of 5 detectives with their nose out of joint because they got conned by a lady.
I will give it 5 out of 5 photos of Ingrid Bergman with the glasses drawn on, because how else are they going to find her? Yeah.
That doesn't look like her. Oh my goodness, that's her with the glasses.
God.
This explains how Clark Kent got away with it for so long.
Yes, awesome. Jarrah, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you making the time today. It's been a lot of fun. Tell everybody where they can find you online. Tell them about Women at Warp.
Yeah, so my podcast is called Women at Warp. We're a feminist Star Trek podcast that you can find at womenatwarp, that's WARP.com. Or you can also find me on Twitter at Jarrah Penguin, that's JARRAH Penguin.
Excellent. Chris, where can people find you when you're not falling in love with Gregory Peck?
Well, when am I not falling in love with Gregory Peck? Sorry, I'm distracted. The listeners, my entire Zoom call, I've been very glitchy in the background because I've had the Bon Appetit kitchen, but it's not working. So I keep disappearing. You can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy. Apart from Good Evening, I do another podcast called North by Nerd West with one of my best mates, Emma Platt, and we just catch up on all kinds of pop culture, and we talk about stuff like feminism and misogyny and kind of intersectionality, and it's a wonderful just kind of mix of stuff, and it's 2 minutes basically catching up. Apart from that, I also guest on a bunch of different podcasts, including Amy Walker's Eccentric Earth, which is a very cool history podcast, on Pete Gaskell's Smorgasbord, which is a fun quiz show, also on Matt Latham's Pick a Disc, which is where guests come on and they explore an album that is near and dear to their hearts. So you can check out my episodes there. And yeah, apart from that, just find me on Twitter. Say hi. I promise I am very, very friendly.
Tom, where can people find you when you're not dropping bromides in my milk?
my Twitter is TomCaldwell3000. Shout out to Outcast. I would like a quick thank you to CBC Saskatchewan Radio and Television. They've been presenting some professional development type seminars for podcasters in Saskatchewan lately. Brandon and I have been taking advantage of those and trying to get the information across to Chris as much as we can. So thank you to them.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And me, you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. I have got a show over on Trek FM called The Line, which is all about Star Trek Picard on the United Federation of Podcast Network. My friend Zach Moore and I have a show called Franchise Fatigue, which is all about movies, remakes, and sequels. And coming this fall on the Nerd Party Network, John Mills and Tristan Riddell and myself, we're doing a show called House of Fincher, which is going through all of David Fincher's films leading up to the release of his new Netflix film, Mank, which should be coming out sometime this fall. I'm eagerly waiting for some more news on that one. But that's been a whole heck of a lot of fun. And tonight I'm going to be recording our episode on House of Cards. And the first two episodes were directed by Fincher. Thank you so much to the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting us, and thank you to all the gents over there. Please check out our good friends Annie and Catherine. They have a podcast called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast, and they go through all of the episodes of that show, and that is a great listen. With their show and our show combined, you get a near comprehensive look at the Grand Master's work. And thank you so much to Jason Cullimore for our amazing, amazing theme song. Well, that's all we've got for you this time. Next time, it's Notorious, once again with the beautiful, amazing Ingrid Bergman, not to be confused with Ingmar Bergman, although they would be seen together many times in the past. But until then, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening.